fair way to be partners with Joe and to keep company with Biddy. When all in a moment, some confounding remembrance of the Havisham days would fall upon me like a destructive missile and scatter my wits again. Scattered wits take a long time picking up, and often before I had got them well together, they would be dispersed in all directions by one stray thought, that perhaps, after all, Miss Havisham was going to make my fortune when my time was out. If my time had run out, it would have left me still at the height of my perplexities, I dare say. It never did run out, however, but was brought to a premature end, as I proceed to relate. Chapter 18. It was in the fourth year of my apprenticeship to Joe, and it was a Saturday night. There was a group assembled round the fire of the Three Jolly Bargemen, attentive to Mr. Wopsle as he read the newspaper aloud. Of that group, I was one. A highly popular murder had been committed, and Mr. Wopsle was imbrued in blood to the eyebrows. He gloated over every abhorrent adjective in the description, and identified himself with every witness at the inquest. He faintly moaned, "I am done for," as the victim, and he barbarously bellowed, "I'll serve you out," as the murderer. He gave the medical testimony in pointed imitation of our local practitioner, and he piped and shook as the aged turnpike keeper who had heard blows to an extent so very paralytic as to suggest a doubt regarding the mental competency of that witness. The coroner, in Mr. Wopsle's hands, became Timon of Athens, the beadle Coriolanus. He enjoyed himself thoroughly, and we all enjoyed ourselves, and were delightfully comfortable. In this cosy state of mind, we came to the verdict, willful murder. Then, and not sooner, I became aware of a strange gentleman leaning over the back of the settle opposite me, looking on. There was an expression of contempt on his face, and he bit the side of a great forefinger as he watched the group of faces.
"Well," said the stranger to Mr. Wopsle when the reading was done, "you have settled it all to your own satisfaction, I have no doubt."
Everybody started and looked up as if it were the murderer. He looked at everybody coldly and sarcastically.
"Guilty, of course," said he. "Out with it. Come."
"Sir," returned Mr. Wopsle, "without having the honour of your acquaintance, I do say guilty."
Upon this, we all took courage to unite in a confirmatory murmur.
"I know you do," said the stranger. "I knew you would. I told you so. But now I'll ask you a question. Do you know, or do you not know, that the law of England supposes every man to be innocent until he is proved to be guilty?"
"Sir," Mr. Wopsle began to reply, "as an Englishman myself, I..."
"Come," said the stranger, biting his forefinger at him. "Don't evade the question. Either you know it or you don't know it. Which is it to be?"
He stood with his head on one side and himself on one side, in a bullying, interrogative manner, and he threw his forefinger at Mr. Wopsle, as it were to mark him out, before biting it again.
"Now," said he, "do you know it, or don't you know it?"
"Certainly I know it," replied Mr. Wopsle.
"Certainly you know it. Then why didn't you say so at first? Now I'll ask you another question,"
taking possession of Mr. Wopsle as if he had a right to him.
"Do you know that none of these witnesses have yet been cross-examined?"
Mr. Wopsle was beginning.
"I can only say..."
when the stranger stopped him.
"What? You won't answer the question? Yes or no? Now I'll try you again,"
throwing his finger at him again.
"Attend to me. Are you aware or are you not aware that none of these witnesses have not been cross-examined? Come, I only want one word from you. Yes or no?"
Mr. Wopsle hesitated, and we all began to conceive rather a poor opinion of him.
"Come," said the stranger. "I'll help you. You don't deserve help, but I'll help you. Look at that paper you hold in your hand. What is it?"
"What is it?"
repeated Mr. Wopsle, eyeing it much at a loss.
"Is it?"
pursued the stranger in his most sarcastic and suspicious manner.
"The printed paper you have just been reading from?"
"Undoubtedly."
"Undoubtedly. Now turn to that paper, and tell me whether it distinctly states that the prisoner expressly said that his legal advisers instructed him altogether to reserve his defence."
"I read that just now," Mr. Wopsle pleaded.
"Never mind what you read just now, sir. I don't ask you what you read just now. You may read the Lord's Prayer backwards, if you like, and perhaps have done it before today. Turn to the paper. No, 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 my friend. Not to the top of the column. You know better than that. To the bottom. To the bottom."
We all began to think Mr. Wopsle full of subterfuge.
"Well, have you found it?"
"Here it is," said Mr. Wopsle.
"Now, follow that passage with your eye, and tell me whether it distinctly states that the prisoner expressly said that he was instructed by his legal advisers wholly to reserve his defence. Come, do you make that of it?"
Mr. Wopsle answered, "Those are not the exact words."
"Not the exact words," repeated the gentleman bitterly. "Is that the exact substance?"
"Yes," said Mr. Wopsle.
"Yes,"
repeated the stranger, looking round at the rest of the company with his right hand extended towards the witness, Wopsle.
"Now I ask you what you say to the conscience of that man who, with that passage before his eyes, can lay his head upon his pillow after having pronounced a fellow creature guilty, unheard."
We all began to suspect that Mr. Wopsle was not the man we'd thought him, and that he was beginning to be found out.
"And that same man, remember," pursued the gentleman, throwing his finger at Mr. Wopsle heavily, "that same man might be summoned as a juryman upon this very trial, and having thus deeply committed himself, might return to the bosom of his family and lay his head upon his pillow after deliberately swearing that he would well and truly try the issue joined between our sovereign lord the king and the prisoner at the bar, and would a true verdict give according to the evidence, so help him God."
We were all deeply persuaded that the unfortunate Wopsle had gone too far, and had better stop in his reckless career while there was yet time. The strange gentleman, with an air of authority not to be disputed, and with a manner expressive of knowing something secret about every one of us that would effectually do for each individual if he chose to disclose it, left the back of the settle, and came into the space between the two settles in front of the fire, where he remained standing, his left hand in his pocket, and he biting the forefinger of his right.
"From information I have received," said he, looking round at us as we all quailed before him, "I have reason to believe there is a blacksmith among you by name Joseph or Joe Gargery. Which is the man?"
"Here is the man," said Joe. The strange gentleman beckoned him out of his place, and Joe went.
"You have an apprentice," pursued the stranger, "commonly known as Pip. Is he here?"
"I am here," I cried. The stranger did not recognize me, but I recognized him as the gentleman I had met on the stairs on the occasion of my second visit to Miss Havisham. I had known him the moment I saw him looking over the settle, and now that I had stood confronting him with his hand upon my shoulder, I checked off again in detail his large head, his dark complexion, his deep-set eyes, his bushy black eyebrows, his large watch-chain, his strong black dots of beard and whisker, and even the smell of scented soap on his great hand.
"I wish to have a private conference with you two," said he, when he had surveyed me at his leisure. "It will take a little time. Perhaps we had better go to your place of residence. I prefer not to anticipate my communication here. You will impart as much or as little of it as you please to your friends afterwards. I have nothing to do with that."
Amidst a wondering silence, we three walked out of the Jolly Bargeman, and in a wondering silence, walked home. While going along, the strange gentleman occasionally looked at me, and occasionally bit the side of his finger. As we neared home, Joe, vaguely acknowledging the occasion as an impressive and ceremonious one, went on ahead to open the front door. Our conference was held in the state parlour, which was feebly lighted by one candle. It began with the strange gentleman sitting down at the table, drawing the candle to him and looking over some entries in his pocketbook. He then put up the pocketbook and set the candle a little aside, after peering round into the darkness at Joe and me to ascertain which was which.
"My name," he said, "is Jaggers, and I am a lawyer in London. I am pretty well known. I have unusual business to transact with you, and I commence by explaining that it is not of my originating. If my advice had been asked, I should not have been here. It was not asked, and you see me here. What I have to do as the confidential agent of another, I do. No less, no more."
Finding that he could not see us very well from where he sat, he got up and threw one leg over the back of a chair and leaned upon it, thus having one foot on the seat of the chair and one foot on the ground.
"Now, Joseph Gargery, I am the bearer of an offer to relieve you of this young fellow, your apprentice. You would not object to cancel his indentures at his request and for his good. You would not want anything for so doing."
"Lord forbid that I should want anything for not standing in Pep's way," said Joe, staring.
"Lord forbidding is pious, but not to the purpose," returned Mr. Jaggers. "The question is, would you want anything? Do you want anything?"
"The answer is," returned Joe sternly, "no."
I thought Mr. Jaggers glanced at Joe as if he considered him a fool for his disinterestedness, but I was too much bewildered between breathless curiosity and surprise to be sure of it.
"Very well," said Mr. Jaggers. "Recollect the admission you have made, and don't try to go from it presently."
"Who's going to try?" retorted Joe.
"I don't say anybody is. Do you keep a dog?"
"Yes, I do keep a dog."
"Bear in mind, then, that Brag is a good dog, but Hold Fast is a better. Bear that in mind, will you?"
repeated Mr. Jaggers, shutting his eyes and nodding his head at Joe, as if he were forgiving him something.
"Now I return to this young fellow, and the communication I have got to make is that he has great expectations."
Joe and I gasped and looked at one another.
"I am instructed to communicate to him," said Mr. Jaggers, throwing his finger at me sideways, "that he will come into a handsome property. Further, that it is the desire of the present possessor of that property that he be immediately removed from his present sphere of life and from this place and be brought up as a gentleman. In a word, as a young fellow of great expectations."
My dream was out. My wild fancy was surpassed by sober reality. Miss Havisham was going to make my fortune on a grand scale.
"Now, Mr. Pip," pursued the lawyer, "I address the rest of what I have to say to you. You are to understand first that it is the request of the person from whom I take my instructions that you always bear the name of Pip. You will have no objection, I dare say, to your great expectations being encumbered with that easy condition. But if you have any objection, this is the time to mention it."
My heart was beating so fast, and there was such a singing in my ears that I could scarcely stammer, "I had no objection."
"I should think not. Now you are to understand, secondly, Mr. Pip, that the name of the person who is your liberal benefactor remains a profound secret until the person chooses to reveal it. I am empowered to mention
that it is the intention of the person to reveal it at first hand by word of mouth to yourself. When or where that intention may be carried out, I cannot say. No one can say. It may be years hence. Now you are distinctly to understand that you are most positively prohibited from making any inquiry on this head, or any allusion or reference, however distant, to any individual whomsoever as the individual in all communications you may have with me. If you have a suspicion in your own breast, keep that suspicion in your own breast. It is not the least to the purpose what the reasons of this prohibition are. They may be the strongest and gravest reasons, or they may be mere whim. This is not for you to inquire into. The condition is laid down. Your acceptance of it and your observation of it as binding is the only remaining condition that I am charged with by the person from whom I take my instructions and for whom I am not otherwise responsible. That person is the person from whom you derive your expectations, and the secret is solely held by that person and by me. Again, not a very difficult condition with which to encumber such a rise in fortune. But if you have any objection to it, this is the time to mention it. Speak out. Once more, I stammered with difficulty that I had no objections.
I should think not.
Now, Mr. Pip, I have done with stipulations. Though he called me Mr. Pip, and began rather to make up to me, he still could not get rid of a certain air of bullying suspicion, and even now he occasionally shut his eyes and threw his finger at me while he spoke, as much as to express that he knew all kinds of things to my disparagement, if he only chose to mention them.
We come next to mere details of arrangement. You must know that although I use the term expectations more than once, you are not endowed with expectations only. There is already lodged in my hands a sum of money amply sufficient for your suitable education and maintenance. You will please consider me your guardian.
Oh, for I was going to thank him. I tell you at once, I am paid for my services, or I shouldn't render them. It is considered that you must be better educated in accordance with your altered position, and that you will be alive to the importance and necessity of at once entering on that advantage.
I said I had always longed for it.
Never mind what you have always longed for, Mr. Pip, he retorted. Keep to the record. If you long for it now, that's enough. Am I answered that you are ready to be placed at once under some proper tutor? Is that it?
I stammered, yes, that was it.
Good. Now, your inclinations are to be consulted. I don't think that wise, mind, but it's my trust. Have you ever heard of any tutor whom you would prefer to another?
I had never heard of any tutor but Biddy and Mr. Wopsle's great-aunt, so I replied in the negative.
There is a certain tutor of whom I have some knowledge who I think might suit the purpose, said Mr. Jaggers. I don't recommend him, observe, because I never recommend anybody. The gentleman I speak is one Mr. Matthew Pocket.
Ah, I caught at the name directly. Miss Havisham's relation, the Matthew whom Mr. and Mrs. Camilla had spoken of, the Matthew whose place was to be at Miss Havisham's head when she lay dead in her bride's dress on the bride's table.
You know the name?
Said Mr. Jaggers, looking shrewdly at me, and then shutting up his eyes while he waited for an answer. My answer was that I had heard of the name.
Ah, said he, you have heard of the name. But the question is, what do you say of it?
I said, or tried to say, that I was much obliged to him for his recommendation.
No, my young friend,
he interrupted, shaking his great head very slowly.
Recollect yourself.
Not recollecting myself, I began again that I was much obliged to him for his recommendation.
No, my young friend,
he interrupted, shaking his great head and frowning and smiling both at once.
No, no, no. It's very well done, but it won't do. You are too young to fix me with it. Recommendation is not the word, Mr. Pip. Try another.
Correcting myself, I said that I was much obliged to him for his mention of Mr. Matthew Pocket.
That's more like it, cried Mr. Jaggers.
And, I added, I would gladly try that gentleman.
Good. You had better try him in his own house. The way shall be prepared for you, and you can see his son first, who is in London. When will you come to London?
I said, glancing at Joe, who stood looking on motionless, that I supposed I could come directly.
First, said Mr. Jaggers, you should have some new clothes to come in, and they should not be working clothes. Say this day week, you all want some money. Shall I leave you 20 guineas?
He produced a long purse with the greatest coolness, and counted them out on the table and pushed them over to me. This was the first time he had taken his leg from the chair. He sat astride of the chair when he had pushed the money over, and sat swinging his purse and eyeing Joe.
Well, Joseph Gargery, you look dumbfounded.
I am,
said Joe in a very decided manner.
It was understood that you wanted nothing for yourself, remember?
It were understood, said Joe, and it are understood, and it ever will be similar according.
But what?
Said Mr. Jaggers, swinging his purse.
What if it was in my instructions to make you a present as compensation?
As compensation what for? Joe demanded.
For the loss of his services.
Joe laid his hand upon my shoulder with the touch of a woman. I have often thought him since like the steam hammer that can crush a man or pat an eggshell in his combination of strength with gentleness.
Pip is that hearty welcome, said Joe, to go free with his services to honour and fortune, as no words can tell him. But if you think as money can make compensation to me for the loss of the little child, what come to the forge, and ever the best of friends— Oh, dear good Joe, whom I was so ready to leave and so unthankful to, I see you again with your muscular blacksmith's arm before your eyes, and your broad chest heaving, and your voice dying away. Oh, dear good faithful tender Joe, I feel the loving tremble of your hand upon my arm, as solemnly this day as if it had been the rustle of an angel's wing. But I encouraged Joe at the time. I was lost in the mazes of my future fortunes, and could not retrace the bypaths we had trodden together. I begged Joe to be comforted, for, as he said, we had ever been the best of friends, and, as I said, we ever would be so. Joe scooped his eyes with his disengaged wrist, as if he were bent on gouging himself, but said not another word. Mr. Jaggers had looked on at this, as one who recognized in Joe the village idiot, and in me his keeper. When it was over, he said, weighing in his hand the purse he had ceased to swing.
Now, Joseph Gargery, I warn you, this is your last chance. No half measures with me. If you mean to take a present that I have it in charge to make you, speak out, and you shall have it. If, on the contrary, you mean to say,
here, to his great amazement, he was stopped by Joe's suddenly working round him with every demonstration of a fell pugilistic purpose.
"Which I mean to say," cried Joe, "that if you come into my place bull-baiting and badgering me, come out, which I mean to say as such as you're a man, come on, which I mean to say that what I mean to say and stand or fall by."
I drew Joe away, and he immediately became placable, merely stating to me in an obliging manner, and as a polite expostulatory notice to anyone whom it might happen to concern, that he were not a-going to be bull-baited and badgered in his own place. Mr. Jaggers had risen when Joe demonstrated, and had backed near the door. Without evincing any inclination to come in again, he there delivered his valedictory remarks. They were these.
"Well, Mr. Pip, I think the sooner you leave here, as you are to be a gentleman, the better. Let it stand for this day week, and you shall receive my printed address in the meantime. You can take a hackney coach at the stagecoach office in London and come straight to me. Understand that I express no opinion, one way or other, on the trust I undertake. I am paid for undertaking it, and I do so. Now understand that, finally. Understand that.
He was throwing his finger at both of us, and I think would have gone on, but for his seeming to think Joe dangerous and going off. Something came into my head which induced me to run after him as he was going down to the Jolly Bargeman, where he had left a hired carriage. "I beg your pardon, Mr. Jaggers."
"Hello?" said he, facing round. "What's the matter?"
"I wish to be quite right, Mr. Jaggers, and to keep to your directions, so I thought I had better ask, would there be any objection to my taking leave of anyone I know about here before I go away?"
"No,"
said he, looking as if he hardly understood me. "I don't mean in the village only, but uptown."
"No," said he. "No objection."
I thanked him and ran home again, and there I found that Joe had already locked the front door and vacated the state parlour and was seated by the kitchen fire with his hand on each knee, gazing intently at the burning coals. I, too, sat down before the fire and gazed at the coals, and nothing was said for a long time. My sister was in her cushioned chair in her corner, and Biddy sat at her needlework before the fire, and Joe sat next Biddy, and I sat next Joe in the corner opposite my sister. The more I looked into the glowing coals, the more incapable I became of looking at Joe. The longer the silence lasted, the more unable I felt to speak. At length I got out, "Joe, have you told Biddy?"
"No, Pip,"
returned Joe, still looking at the fire and holding his knees tight, as if he had private information that they intended to make off somewhere.
"Which I left it to yourself, Pip."
"I would rather you told Joe."
"Pip's a gentleman of fortune, then," said Joe, "and God bless him in it."
Biddy dropped her work and looked at me. Joe held his knees and looked at me. I looked at both of them. After a pause, they both heartily congratulated me, but there was a certain touch of sadness in their congratulations that I rather resented. I took it upon myself to impress Biddy, and through Biddy, Joe, with the grave obligation I considered my friends under to know nothing and to say nothing about the maker of my fortune. It would all come out in good time, I observed, and in the meanwhile, nothing was to be said, save that I had come into some great expectations from a mysterious patron. Biddy nodded her head thoughtfully at the fire as she took up her work again, and said she would be very particular, and Joe, still detaining his knees, said,
"Aye, aye, I'll be a cavalry particular, Pip."
And then they congratulated me again, and went on to express so much wonder at the notion of my being a gentleman that I didn't half like it. Infinite pains were then taken by Biddy to convey to my sister some idea of what had happened. To the best of my belief, those efforts entirely failed. She laughed and nodded her head a great many times, and even repeated after Biddy the words "Pip" and "property," but I doubt if they had more meaning in them than an election cry, and I cannot suggest a darker picture of her state of mind. I never could have believed it without experience, but as Joe and Biddy became more at their cheerful ease again, I became quite gloomy. Dissatisfied with my fortune, of course, I could not be, but it is possible that I may have been, without quite knowing it, dissatisfied with myself. Anyhow, I sat with my elbow on my knee, my face upon my hand, looking into the fire, as those two talked about my going away, and about what they should do without me, and all that. And whenever I caught one of them looking at me, though never so pleasantly, and they often looked at me, particularly Biddy, I felt offended, as if they were expressing some mistrust of me, though heaven knows they never did by word or sign. At those times I would get up and look out at the door, for our kitchen door opened at once upon the night, and stood open on summer evenings to air the room. The very stars to which I then raised my eyes, I am afraid I took to be but poor and humble stars for glittering on the rustic objects among which I had passed my life.
"Saturday night,"
said I, when we sat at our supper of bread and cheese and beer.
5 more days, and then the day before the day. They'll soon go.
"Yes, Pep,"
observed Joe, whose voice sounded hollow in his beer mug.
"They'll soon go."
"Soon, soon go," said Biddy.
"I've been thinking, Joe, that when I go downtown on Monday and order my new clothes, I shall tell the tailor that I'll come and put them on there, or that I'll have them sent to Mr. Pumblechook's. It will be very disagreeable to be stared at by all the people here."
"Mr. and Mrs. Hubble might like to see you in your new genteel figure too, Pep,"
said Joe, industriously cutting his bread with his cheese on it in the palm of his left hand, and glancing at my untasted supper, as if he thought of the time when we used to compare slices.
"So might Wopsle, and the jolly bargeman might take it as a compliment."
"That's just what I don't want, Joe. They would make such a business of it, such a coarse and common business, that I couldn't bear myself."
"Ah, that indeed, Pip," said Joe. "If you couldn't abear yourself—"
Biddy asked me here, as she sat holding my sister's plate,
"Have you thought about when you'll show yourself to Mr. Gargery and your sister and me? You will show yourself to us, won't you?"
"Biddy," I returned with some resentment, "you are so exceedingly quick that it's difficult to keep up with you."
"She always were quick," observed Joe.
"If you had waited another moment, Biddy, you would have heard me say that I shall bring my clothes here in a bundle one evening, most likely on the evening before I go away."
Biddy said no more.
Handsomely forgiving her, I soon exchanged an affectionate good night with her and Joe, and went up to bed. When I got into my little room, I sat down and took a long look at it, as a mean little room that I should soon be parted from and raised above for ever. It was furnished with fresh young remembrances, too, and even at the same moment I fell into much the same confused division of mind between it and the better rooms to which I was going, as I had been in so often between the Forge and Miss Havisham's, and Biddy and Estella. The sun had been shining brightly all day on the roof of my attic, and the room was warm. As I put the window open and stood looking out, I saw Joe come slowly forth at the dark door below and take a turn or two in the air, and then I saw Biddy come and bring him a pipe and light it for him. He never smoked so late, and it seemed to hint to me that he wanted comforting for some reason or other. He presently stood at the door immediately beneath me, smoking his pipe, and Biddy stood there too, quietly talking to him, and I knew that they talked of me, for I heard my name mentioned in an endearing tone by both of them more than once. I would not have listened for more if I could have heard more, so I drew away from the window and sat down in my one chair by the bedside, feeling it very sorrowful and strange that this first night of my bright fortunes should be the loneliest I had ever known. Looking towards the open window, I saw light wreaths from Joe's pipe floating there, and I fancied it was like a blessing from Joe, not obtruded on me or paraded before me, but pervading the air we shared together. I put my light out and crept into bed, and it was an uneasy bed now, and I never slept the old sound sleep in it any more. Chapter 19. Morning made a considerable difference in my general prospect of life, and brightened it so much that it scarcely seemed the same. What lay heaviest on my mind was the consideration that 6 days intervened between me and the day of departure, for I could not divest myself of a misgiving that something might happen to London in the meanwhile, and that when I got there it might be either greatly deteriorated or clean gone. Joe and Biddy were very sympathetic and pleasant when I spoke of our approaching separation, but they only referred to it when I did. After breakfast, Joe brought out my indentures from the press in the best parlour, and we put them in the fire, and I felt that I was free. With all the novelty of my emancipation on me, I went to church with Joe, and thought perhaps the clergyman wouldn't have read that about the rich man and the kingdom of heaven if he had known all. After our early dinner, I strolled out alone, proposing to finish off the marshes at once and get them done with. As I passed the church, I felt, as I had felt during the service in the morning, a sublime compassion for the poor creatures who were destined to go there Sunday after Sunday all their lives through, and to lie obscurely at last among the low green mounds. I promised myself that I would do something for them one of these days, and formed a plan in outline for bestowing a dinner of roast beef and plum pudding, a pint of ale and a gallon of condescension, upon everybody in the village. If I had often thought before, with something allied to shame, of my companionship with the fugitive whom I had once seen limping among these graves, what were my thoughts on this Sunday, when the place recalled the wretch, ragged and shivering, with his felon iron and badge? My comfort was that it happened a long time ago, and that he had doubtless been transported a long way off, and that he was dead to me, and might be veritably dead into the bargain. No more low, wet grounds, no more dikes and sluices, no more of these grazing cattle, though they seemed in their dull manner to wear a more respectful air now, and to face round in order that they might stare as long as possible at the possessor of such great expectations. Farewell, monotonous acquaintances of my childhood. Henceforth I was for London and greatness, not for Smith's work in general and for you. I made my exultant way to the old battery, and lying down there to consider the question whether Miss Havisham intended me for Estella, fell asleep. When I awoke, I was much surprised to find Joe sitting beside me, smoking his pipe. He greeted me with a cheerful smile on my opening my eyes, and said, "As being the last time, Pip, I thought I'd follow. And, Joe, I'm very glad you did so." "Thank you, Pip." "You may be sure, dear Joe," I went on after we had shaken hands, "that I shall never forget you."
"No, no, Pip," said Joe in a comfortable tone. "I'm sure of that. Aye, aye, old chap. Bless you, it were only necessary to get it well round in a man's mind to be certain on it. But it took a bit of time to get it well round. The change comes so uncommon plump, didn't it?"
Somehow, I was not best pleased with Joe's being so mightily secure of me. I should have liked him to have betrayed emotion, or to have said, "It does you credit, Pip," or something of that sort. Therefore, I made no remark on Joe's first head, merely saying, as to his second, that the tidings had indeed come suddenly, but that I had always wanted to be a gentleman, and had often and often speculated on what I would do if I were one.
"Have you, though?" said Joe. "Astonishing."
"It's a pity now, Joe," said I, "that you did not get on a little more, when we had our lessons here, isn't it?"
"Well, I don't know," returned Joe. "I'm so awful dull. I'm only master of my own trade. It was always a pity as I was so awful dull, but it's no more of a pity now than it was this day 12 months. Don't you see?"
What I had meant was that when I came into my property and was able to do something for Joe, it would have been much more agreeable if he'd been better qualified for a rise in station. He was so perfectly innocent of my meaning, however, that I thought I would mention it to Biddy in preference. So when we had walked home and had had tea, I took Biddy into our little garden by the side of the lane, and after throwing out in a general way for the elevation of her spirits that I should never forget her, said I had a favour to ask of her. "And it is, Biddy," said I, "that you will not omit any opportunity of helping Joe on a little."
"How, helping him on?" asked Biddy, with a steady sort of glance.
"Well, Joe is a dear good fellow. In fact, I think he is the dearest fellow that ever lived. But he is rather backward in some things. For instance, Biddy, in his learnings and his manners." Although I was looking at Biddy as I spoke, and although she opened her eyes very wide when I had spoken, she did not look at me.
"Oh, his manners. Won't his manners do, then?" asked Biddy, plucking a black currant leaf.
Oh, my dear Biddy, they do very well here.
Oh, they do very well here, interrupted Biddy, looking closely at the leaf in her hand.
Hear me out. But if I were to remove Joe into a higher sphere, as I shall hope to remove him when I fully come into my property, they would hardly do him justice.
And don't you think he knows that? Asked Biddy. It was such a very provoking question, for it had never in the almost distant manner occurred to me, that I said snappishly, Biddy, what do you mean?
Biddy, having rubbed the leaf to pieces between her hands, and the smell of a blackcurrant bush has ever since recalled to me that evening in the little garden by the side of the lane, said, Have you never considered that he may be proud?
Proud? I repeated, with disdainful emphasis.
Oh, there are many kinds of pride, said Biddy, looking full at me and shaking her head. Pride is not all of one kind.
Well, what are you stopping for? Said I.
Not all of one kind, resumed Biddy. He may be too proud to let anyone take him out of a place that he is competent to fill, and fills well, and with respect. To tell you the truth, I think he is, though it sounds bold in me to say so, for you must know him far better than I do.
Now, Biddy, said I, I'm very sorry to see this in you. I did not expect to see this in you.
You're envious, Biddy, and grudging. You're dissatisfied on account of my rise in fortune, and you can't help showing it.
If you have the heart to think so, returned Biddy, say so. Say so over and over again, if you have the heart to think so.
If you have the heart to be so, you mean, Biddy, said I in a virtuous and superior tone. Don't put it off upon me. I'm very sorry to see it, and it's a bad side of human nature. I did intend to ask you to use any little opportunities you might have after I was gone of improving dear Joe. But after this, I ask you nothing. I'm extremely sorry to see this in you, Biddy, I repeated. It's a bad side of human nature.
Whether you scold me or approve of me, returned poor Biddy, you may equally depend upon my trying to do all that lies in my power here at all times, and whatever opinion you take away of me shall make no difference in my remembrance of you. Yet a gentleman should not be unjust neither, said Biddy, turning away her head. I again warmly repeated that it was a bad side of human nature, in which sentiment, waiving its application, I have since seen reason to think I was right. And I walked down the little path away from Biddy, and Biddy went into the house, and I went out to the garden gate and took a dejected stroll until supper time. Again feeling it very sorrowful and strange that this, the second night of my bright fortunes, should be as lonely and unsatisfactory as the first. But morning once more brightened my view, and I extended my clemency to Biddy, and we dropped the subject. Putting on the best clothes I had, I went into town as early as I could hope to find the shops open, and presented myself before Mr. Trabb, the tailor, who was having his breakfast in the parlour behind his shop, and who did not think it worth his while to come out to me, but called me into him.
"Well," said Mr. Trabb, in a hail-fellow well-met kind of way, "how are you, and what can I do for you?"
Mr. Trabb had sliced his hot roll into three feather beds and was slipping butter in between the blankets and covering it up. He was a prosperous old bachelor, and his open window looked into a prosperous little garden and orchard, and there was a prosperous iron safe let into the wall at the side of his fireplace, and I did not doubt that heaps of his prosperity were put away in it in bags.
"Mr. Trabb," said I, "it's an unpleasant thing to have to mention, because it looks like boasting, but I have come into a handsome property."
A change passed over Mr. Trabb. He forgot the butter in bed, got up from the bedside, and wiped his fingers on the tablecloth, exclaiming,
"Lord bless my soul!"
"I'm going up to my guardian in London," said I, casually drawing some guineas out of my pocket and looking at them, "and I want a fashionable suit of clothes to go in. I wish to pay for them," I added, otherwise I thought he might only pretend to make them, "with ready money."
"My dear sir,"
said Mr. Trabb, as he respectfully bent his body, opened his arms, and took the liberty of touching me on the outside of each elbow.
"Don't hurt me by mentioning that. May I venture to congratulate you? Or would you do me the favour of stepping into the shop?"
Mr. Trabb's boy was the most audacious boy in all that countryside. When I had entered, he was sweeping the shop, and he had sweetened his labours by sweeping over me. He was still sweeping when I came out into the shop with Mr. Trabb, and he knocked the broom against all possible corners and obstacles to express, as I understood it, equality with any blacksmith, alive or dead.
"Hold that noise," said Mr. Trabb with the greatest sternness, "or I'll knock your head off. Do me the favour to be seated, sir. Now this," said Mr. Trabb, taking down a roll of cloth and tidying it out in a flowing manner over the counter, preparatory to getting his hand under it to show the gloss, "is a very sweet article. I can recommend it for your purpose, sir, because it really is extra super. But you shall see some others. Give me number 4, you."
To the boy, and with a dreadfully severe stare, foreseeing the danger of that miscreant's brushing me with it, or making some other sign of familiarity. Mr. Trabb never removed his stern eye from the boy until he had deposited number 4 on the counter and was at a safe distance again. Then he commanded him to bring number 5 and number 8.
"And let me have none of your tricks here," said Mr. Trabb, "or you shall repent it, you young scoundrel, the longest day you have to live."
Mr. Trabb then bent over number 4, and in a sort of deferential confidence recommended it to me as a light article for summer wear, an article much in vogue among the nobility and gentry, an article that it would ever be an honour to him to reflect upon a distinguished fellow townsman, if he might claim me for a fellow townsman, having worn.
"Are you bringing numbers 5 and 8, you vagabond?" said Mr. Trabb to the boy after that, "or shall I kick you out of the shop and bring them myself?"
I selected the materials for a suit, with the assistance of Mr. Trabb's judgment, and re-entered the parlour to be measured. For although Mr. Trabb had my measure already, and had previously been quite contented with it, he said apologetically that it wouldn't do under existing circumstances, sir, wouldn't do at all. So Mr. Trabb measured and calculated me in the parlour, as if I were an estate and he the finest species of surveyor, and gave himself such a world of trouble that I felt that no suit of clothes could possibly remunerate him for his pains. When he had at last done, and had appointed to send the articles to Mr. Pumblechook's on the Thursday evening, he said, with his hand upon the parlour lock,
"I know, sir, that London gentlemen cannot be expected to patronise local work as a rule, but if you would give me a turn now and then in the quality of a townsman, I should greatly esteem it. Good morning, sir. Much obliged. Door!"
The last word was flung at the boy, who had not the least notion what it meant. But I saw him collapse as his master rubbed me out with his hands, and my first decided experience of the stupendous power of money was that it had morally laid upon his back, Trabb's boy. After this memorable event, I went to the hatters, and the bootmakers, and the hosiers, and felt rather like Mother Hubbard's dog, whose outfit required the services of so many trades. I also went to the coach office, and took my place for 7 o'clock on Saturday morning. It was not necessary to explain everywhere that I had come into a handsome property, but whenever I said anything to that effect, it followed that the officiating tradesman ceased to have his attention diverted through the window by the High Street, and concentrated his mind upon me. When I had ordered everything I wanted, I directed my steps towards Pumblechook's, and as I approached that gentleman's place of business, I saw him standing at his door. He was waiting for me with great impatience. He had been out early with the chaise cart, and had called at the forge and heard the news. He had prepared a collation for me in the Barnwell parlour, and he, too, ordered his shopman to come out of the gangway as my sacred person passed.
"My dear friend," said Mr. Pumblechook, taking me by both hands when he and I and the collation were alone, "I give you joy of your good fortune. Well deserved, well deserved."
This was coming to the point, and I thought it a sensible way of expressing himself.
"To think," said Mr. Pumblechook, after snorting admiration at me for some moments,
The vase should have been the humble instrument of leading up to this, is a proud reward.
I begged Mr. Pumblechook to remember that nothing was to be ever said or hinted on that point.
My dear young friend, said Mr. Pumblechook, if you will allow me to call you so.
I murmured certainly, and Mr. Pumblechook took me by both hands again and communicated a movement to his waistcoat, which had an emotional appearance, though it was rather low down.
My dear young friend, rely upon my doing my little all in your absence by keeping the fact before the mind of Joseph. Joseph, said Mr. Pumblechook, in the way of a compassionate adjuration. Joseph, Joseph.
Thereupon he shook his head and tapped it, expressing his sense of deficiency in Joseph.
But my dear young friend, said Mr. Pumblechook, you must be hungry, you must be exhausted. Be seated. Here is a chicken had round from the boar. Here is a tongue had round from the boar. Here is one or two little things had round from the boar that I hope you may not despise. But do I, said Mr. Pumblechook, getting up again the moment after he had sat down, see afore me him as I ever sported with in his time of happy infancy. And may I,
this may I meant might he shake hands. I consented, and he was fervent, and then sat down again.
Here is wine, said Mr. Pumblechook. Let us drink. Thanks to fortune, and may she ever pick out her favourites with equal judgment. And yet I cannot, said Mr. Pumblechook, getting up again, see afore me one, and likewise drink to one without again expressing, may I?
I said he might. And he shook hands with me again and emptied his glass and turned it upside down. I did the same, and if I had turned myself upside down before drinking, the wine could not have gone more direct to my head. Mr. Pumblechook helped me to the liver wing and to the best slice of tongue, none of those out-of-the-way no-thoroughfares of pork now, and took, comparatively speaking, no care of himself at all.
"Ah, poultry, poultry, you little thought," said Mr. Pumblechook, apostrophizing the fowl in the dish, "when you was a young fledgling, what was in store for you? You little thought you was to be a refreshment beneath this humble roof for one as—call it a weakness, if you will," said Mr. Pumblechook, getting up again. "But may I—"
It began to be unnecessary to repeat the form of saying he might, so he did it at once. How he ever did it so often without wounding himself with my knife, I don't know.
And your sister, he resumed after a little steady eating, which had the honour of bringing you up by hand. It's a sad picture to reflect that she's no longer equal to fully understanding the honour.
I saw he was about to come at me again, and I stopped him.
We'll drink your health, said I.
Ah, cried Mr. Pumblechook, leaning back in his chair, quite flaccid with admiration.
That's the way you know him, sir.
I don't know who sir was, but he certainly was not I, and there was no third person present.
That's the way you know the noble-minded, sir, ever forgiving and ever affable. It might, said the servile Pumblechook, putting down his untasted glass in a hurry and getting up again, to a common person have the appearance of repeating, but may I?
When he had done it, he resumed his seat and drank to my sister.
Let us never be blind, said Mr. Pumblechook, to her faults of temper, but it is to be hoped she meant well.
At about this time I began to observe that he was getting flushed in the face. As to myself, I felt all face, steeped in wine and smarting. I mentioned to Mr. Pumblechook that I wished to have my new clothes sent to his house, and he was ecstatic on my so distinguishing him. I mentioned my reason for desiring to avoid observation in the village, and he lauded it to the skies. There was nobody but himself, he intimated, worthy of my confidence. And, in short, might he? Then he asked me tenderly if I remembered our boyish games at sums, and how we had gone together to have me bound apprentice, and, in effect, how he had ever been my favourite fancy and chosen friend. If I had taken 10 times as many glasses of wine as I had, I should have known that he never had stood in that relation towards me, and should in my heart of hearts have repudiated the idea. Yet for all that, I remember feeling convinced that I had been much mistaken in him, and that he was a sensible, practical, good-hearted, prime fellow. By degrees, he fell to reposing such great confidence in me as to ask my advice in reference to his own affairs. He mentioned that there was an opportunity for a great amalgamation and monopoly of the corn and seed trade on those premises, if enlarged, such as had never occurred before in that or any other neighbourhood. What alone was wanting to the realisation of a vast fortune, he considered to be more capital. Those were the two little words, more capital. Now it appeared to him, Pumblechook, that if that capital were got into the business through a sleeping partner, sir, which sleeping partner would have nothing to do but walk in by self or deputy whenever he pleased and examine the books, and walk in twice a year and take his profits away in his pocket to the tune of 50%. It appeared to him that that might be an opening for a young gentleman of spirit, combined with property, which would be worthy of his attention. But what did I think? He had great confidence in my opinion, and what did I think? I gave it as my opinion, wait a bit. The united vastness and distinctness of this view so struck him that he no longer asked if he might shake hands with me, but said he really must, and did. We drank all the wine, and Mr. Pumblechook pledged himself over and over again to keep Joseph up to the mark, I don't know what mark, and to render efficient and constant service, I don't know what service. He also made known to me, for the first time in my life, and certainly after having kept his secret wonderfully well, that he had always said of me, "That boy is no common boy, and mark me, his fortune will be no common fortune." He said with a tearful smile that it was a singular thing to think of now, and I said so too. Finally, I went out into the air, with a dim perception that there was something unwanted in the conduct of the sunshine, and found that I had slumberously got to the turnpike without having taken any account of the road. There I was roused by Mr. Pumblechook's hailing me. He was a long way down the sunny street, and was making expressive gestures for me to stop. I stopped, and he came up breathless.
"No, my dear friend," said he, when he had recovered wind for speech, "not if I can help it. This occasion shall not entirely pass without that ability on your part. May I, as an old friend and well-wisher? May I?"
We shook hands for the 100th time at least, and he ordered a young carter out of my way with the greatest indignation. Then he blessed me, and stood waving his hand to me until I had passed the crook in the road. And then I turned into a field, and had a long nap under a hedge, before I pushed my way home. I had scant luggage to take with me to London, for little of the little I possessed was adapted to my new station. But I began packing that same afternoon, and wildly packed up things that I knew I should want next morning, in a fiction that there was not a moment to be lost. So Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday passed, and on Friday morning I went to Mr. Pumblechook's to put on my new clothes and pay my visit to Miss Havisham. Mr. Pumblechook's own room was given up to me to dress in, and was decorated with clean towels expressly for the event. My clothes were rather a disappointment, of course. Probably every new and eagerly expected garment ever put on since clothes came in fell a trifle short of the wearer's expectation. But after I had had my new suit on some half an hour, and had gone through an immensity of posturing with Mr. Pumblechook's very limited dressing-glass in the futile endeavour to see my legs, it seemed to fit me better. It being market morning at a neighbouring town some 10 miles off, Mr. Pumblechook was not at home. I had not told him exactly when I might leave, and was not likely to shake hands with him again before departing. This was all as it should be, and I went out in my new array, fearfully ashamed of having to pass the shopman, and suspicious, after all, that I was at a personal disadvantage, something like Joe's in his Sunday suit. I went circuitously to Miss Havisham's by all the back ways, and rang at the bell constrainedly on account of the stiff long fingers of my gloves. Sarah Pocket came to the gate, and positively reeled back when she saw me so changed. Her walnut-shell countenance likewise turned from brown to green and yellow.
"You," said she. "You? Good gracious! What do you want?"
"I'm going to London, Miss